searching for alternative Shi'ism. The state's endemic flaws and the country's economic plight barely concerned the ulama establishment. Mujtahids were increasingly seen as part of the power structure, if not always in cahoots with the state. They held sway over the madrasas, including their curricula and the stipends of students. They also distributed funds to their network of followers and could excommunicate at will dissidents, critics, or rivals. There were influential jurists who were accused of bribery and of acting for the benefit of a party that was offering them greater largesse. In 1826, the call for war with Russia further tarnished their image. With the prevalence of Usuli legalism, the rival Akhbari tendency virtually disappeared, except for brief instances of last-ditch resistance. Most significant among such resistance was a scholar of Indian origin, Mirza Muhammad Akhbari, whose anti-Usuli pronouncements were the first of several calling for an end to the Mujtahid's power and control. His pleas to Fath Ali Shah, however, remained unheeded. He also entertained proto-messianic ideas and esoteric interpretations of Shi'ism. His virtual isolation demonstrated the waning of alternative voices within the ulama community. The Mujtahids also faced competition from Sufi orders that had made a successful comeback after an absence of more than a century from the Iranian landscape. Most notably, the Ni'matullahi order, named after the influential 14th-century mystic Shah Ni'matollah Vali, emerged from obscurity and made remarkable gains throughout the Zand period, first in collaboration with the newly revived Ismaili Shi'i community in Kerman, and later in other Iranian cities. Under the leadership of a Perso-Indian mystic with the Sufi title of Ma'sum Ali Shah, died 1798, the Ni'matullahi order recruited from among artisans, madrasa seminarians, merchants, princes, and officials of the Qajar court, especially in Tabriz, and women of the nobility. In the initial stage of its revival in the late 18th century, the Ni'matullahi order was virtually identical with Ismaili Shi'ism, which itself made a comeback in Kerman after a hiatus of more than a century. Soon, the two trends diverged, but a degree of affinity survived between them. The Sufi message provided relief from the tedious world of the madrasa and the stern loftiness of its jurists. It was one attuned to music, poetry, and painting, as well as love for God and for fellow men and women, adoration of beauty, both in nature and human, nocturnal gatherings, and a community of brotherhood. Through mortification, prayers, fasting, and devotion, the Sufis sought the truth, which, among most Shi'i orders, if not all of them, still corresponded to a modified form of Unitarian pantheism. The so-called unity of being, Vahdat-e Vujud, had been cherished in Persian Sufism for many centuries. God was perceived not as a terrifying transcendental lord of vengeance, but as an all-encompassing emanation in all beings. For the Sufis, whether in their speculative writings, mostly commentaries on the Quran and mystical poems, or in their popular exhortations, the divide between human and divine was not unbridgeable. Persian Sufism of the 19th century was distinct from the unyielding Sunni neo-Sufi revival in India and North Africa, which often led to puritanical and revivalist interpretations of Islam. To the Mujtahids, the threat of the Sufis was not only confined to what they labelled as heretical beliefs and corrupt practices. More important, the Sufis' mostly implicit claim to the status of valayat, friendship, rivaled the Mujtahids' religious claim of veloyat, guardianship, as legitimate leaders of the community. The living Sufi guide aimed to liberate believers from stifling rituals and obligations of the Sharia and steer them instead to the path of inner purity. The poetry of the celebrated Ni'matullahi leader, Nur Ali Shah, died 1801, for instance, urged seekers to surpass the superficiality of the Sharia and find the truth in the unfolding mandate of the Sufi saint, a claim that brought them close to the idea of moral representation on behalf of the hidden imam. The Ni'matullahis were part of a wider Sufi revival that swept through Iran during the early 19th century. The mendicant dervishes of the Qasar order, with their curious demeanour and unusual outfits, were familiar sights in the Persian popular landscape. Their chants in praise of Ali, the patron saint of all Shi'i Sufis, were heard in the streets, bazaars, the houses of strength, Zurkhaneh, and the Sufi convents, Khanegah. Use of drugs, commonly hemp and opium, was accompanied by the recitation of lyrical odes and musical instruments. Their alternative lifestyle and unorthodox pronouncements, some relics of a waning Noctavi past with clear antinomian messages, were not mere curiosity, but markers of their persistent nonconformity. The dervishes' widespread network, stretching from Sufi convents in northern India to Central Asia, Anatolia, Iran, Kurdistan, and beyond to the shrine cities of Najaf and Karbala, and to Mecca and Medina, allowed for frequent encounters with urban and rural communities in their path. Their street performances and storytelling in the coffee houses offered ordinary people an outlet to learn about distant lands and peoples, events beyond their limited surroundings, and marvels of the past sacred history. Later in the century, some itinerant dervishes equipped with large portable paintings, pardeh, which they sequentially unrolled to narrate the Shi'i tragedies of Karbala and events of the Day of Judgment in multiple iconic scenes, presented believers with a poignant audiovisual narrative that echoed the stories in the murals in the Armenian churches, such as those in New Julfar. They functioned as compact versions of the Tahziyyeh passion plays. To the Mujtahids, however, the unconventional beliefs and lifestyle of the Sufis and their dervishes were worrying signs of moral corruption and ploys to deceive their followers. They assumed the task of defending public morality under the rubric of commanding the good and forbidding the evil, which required that they combat Sufis not only through numerous polemics produced in the Qajar period, but also by issuing and enforcing fatwas on apostasy. Several leaders of the early Ni'amatullahi revival fell victim to the Mujtahid's anti-Sufi campaign. Ma'asum Ali Shah and a few of his followers were executed in 1798 in Kermanshah by a fatwa of the powerful Usuli Mujtahid Muhammad Ali Behbahani, popularly known as the Sufi Killer, Sufi Kosh. He was the son of Muhammad Bagher Behbahani, founder of the Neo-Usuli school, who earlier challenged the Akhbaris. Ma'asum Ali's favourite pupil, the poet Nur Ali Shah, also died 3 years later under suspicious circumstances. An icon of popular art in the Qajar period, images of Nur Ali Shah as a youthful saint of serene innocence and handsome look were depicted in pictorial rugs, the covers of pen cases, and in metalwork. The endurance of these images mirrored silent praise for the Sufi saint among the artisans and the ordinary folks, in defiance of the jurists and their exhortations. The talented Ni'amatullahi poet and master musician, Muhammad Mushtaq Ali Shah, who is credited with adding a fourth resonator to the three-stringed Persian setar instrument, was killed in 1791 by a mob incited by an Usuli Mujtahid of Kerman. He was condemned for blasphemy for reciting the Quran with musical accompaniment by his setar. The Mujtahid's anti-Sufi campaign enjoyed the blessing of Fath Ali Shah, whose unfavourable attitude toward the Ni'amatullahis dated to their support for the Zands, as in Kerman in 1792. Even though the Mujtahid's campaign under Fath Ali Shah succeeded in containing the growth of Sufi orders, it could not stop them altogether, and least of all within the elite circles. Under Muhammad Shah, himself a Sufi, the Ni'amatullahis benefited from royal patronage and for a while was shielded against further persecution. Haji Mirza Agassi even appointed fellow Sufis to positions of power, including assigning a Ni'amatullahi scholar to the newly revived office of Sadr, to oversee the religious affairs of the kingdom, a move no doubt aimed to harness jurist hegemony. This gesture was not received kindly by the conservative Mujtahids, who by the middle of the century had become even less tolerant of non-orthodox trends. Even traits of mystical philosophy within the madrasa curriculum did not escape charges of heresy. The students of philosophy, almost always followers of Sadr-e-Din Shirazi, were harassed and forced into isolation. Those who endured had to cover their discourse in a garb of Sharia so thick that nothing remained but dreary regurgitation of philosophized acrobatics, devoid of any creativity. To the ulama's chagrin, in 1815, a celebrated Ni'amatullahi scholar produced the most comprehensive exposition in reply to Henry Martin's polemics. His version was adopted as the Qajar state's official response. Another Ni'amatullahi scholar, Zain al-Abidin Shirvani, from Shirvan in today's Republic of Azerbaijan, who travelled the length and breadth of the Islamic lands, produced some of the best geographical travel narratives of the Qajar era. Yet, despite its scholarly grounding and support in high circles, Ni'amatullahi Sufism was not a match for Usulism and the Mojtahed's grip on Iranian society. A greater challenge to the ulama's supremacy, however, came from within the clerical milieu in the form of the Sheikhi theological school. Named after Sheikh Ahmad Ahzai, 1753-1826, a peripatetic scholar from the Shi'i province of Al-Ahsa on the northeastern coast of the Arabian Peninsula, the Sheikhi school appealed to a younger generation of seminarians in search of something more than sheer study of jurisprudence. In the early decades of the 19th century, Ahzai held a reputation as an accomplished scholar of theology and jurisprudence. Above all, he was a practitioner of mystical philosophy, Hechmat, with roots going back to the Mullah Sadra, who, ironically, he denounced as a heretic, and even farther to the familiar older trends of Perso-Islamic Sufism, Neoplatonism, and the Illumination, Eshraq, philosophy. Ahzai's popularity among madrasa students, especially in Karbala, and later with a growing body of followers in Iran, was primarily because of his eclectic approach to Shi'ism, which offered a third alternative to the Sharia of the Mojtahids and the mysticism of the Sufis. He was well-versed in scholastic tradition, but posited a moral, mystical alternative that went beyond the strict legalism of the jurists. His piety, a quality that for centuries marked the behavior of reluctant ascetics in the Shi'i Iranian world, was particularly appealing to some among the merchant classes and other members of the non-elite. Ahzai utilized the rich apocalyptic tradition in Iranian milieu to answer to an essential question in Shi'i theology, namely the extracorporeal existence of the hidden imam in the invisible world, the means of recognizing him, and the time and circumstances of his advent. Ahzai sought salvation for humankind not through sheer religious obligations, but through an intuitive experience of the sacred in a space he called Hur Galya, an intermediary world between the earthly existence and the heavenly world. In the imaginary world of Hur Galya, a concept he borrowed from the 12th century Iranian philosopher Shahab ad-Din Sohrawardi, the hidden imam was invisible to humankind, as were all the souls of the believers as prototypes awaiting the day of resurrection. In this world, the believers who perfected their intellectual and moral potential could meditate on the presence of the imam of the age and experience his manifestation in this world. For Ahzai, the perfect Shia, thus referred to the one who had arrived at this state of visionary perfection and could guide others along the same path. This notion was a reworking of the familiar idea of the perfect man, Ensane Kamel, that had long been contemplated in speculative Sufism. He thus proposed an answer to the troubling question of the hidden imam's thousand-year longevity in a non-physical state by assuming the existence of his celestial prototype in the Hur Galya sphere. Though in his often cryptic works, Ahzai never explicitly stated it, he allowed for the conclusion that the hidden imam would manifest himself in a new earthly body at the end of the time. Such a rendition was a radical departure from conventional Shi'i belief on the subject of the return of the hidden imam. The imam's celestial existence not only facilitated visionary encounters with the imam of the age, but also enabled his eventual return to the world of matter, not as the son of the 11th imam, who, according to mainstream Shi'i belief, had gone to occultation 1,000 years earlier, but in a new metaphorical human caste. Ahzai and his successor also reinterpreted the fantastic signs of the hour, which were a precondition for the apocalyptic return of the hidden imam. The perfect Shia was perceived as a status reserved for Asai himself, and after him by his successor, Sayyid Kazim Rashti, 1793-1843, as the person most conscious of the hidden imam, and who would prepare the preliminary steps before his return. The perfect Shia, and not the Mojtahids, in effect held the true mandate, Veloyat, on behalf of the hidden imam. Human perfection in the Sheikhi school, moreover, required the historical progression in the course of time and called for the eventual return of the hidden imam when time is mature for him to reveal himself from the implicit world of prototypes into the explicit world of reality. The millennial markers in the Shi'i calendar no doubt added to the Sheikhi's messianic preoccupation and its appeal. The approach of a millennium after the presumed occultation of the 12th imam in AH 260, 873-874 CE, corresponded to the year AH 1260, 1844 CE. The latter date played prominently in the Shi'i imagination, invoking messianic speculations. By the 1840s, the Sheikhi school, under Rashti's leadership, had grown into a network distinct from that of the Usulis and in competition with it. Sheikhis consisted mostly of younger madrasa students and the new Mojtahids trained under Asai and Rashti. They were critical of the Usuli jurists for their archaic madrasa education, their futile study of Usul al-Fiqh at the expense of moral and mystical dimensions of religion, and their corruptions and excesses. Ritual symbolism also played a remarkable part in dividing the two communities, especially the visitation of the sacred tombs and shrines. The Sheikhis performed the rite of visitation, ziyarat, in Imam Hussein's shrine in Karbala, by staying at the foot of the tomb as a sign of respect, and by performing visitation in utter humility. The belief in the prototypical existence of the imams made the ritual of visiting their tombs an existential experience. This contrasted the usual Shi'i practice of standing at the head of the tomb, embracing the shrine's outer case, zari, tying rags and padlocks to it to make wishes, and reciting the visitation tablet rather routinely. In the eye of the Sheikhis, these acts were symbols of utter irreverence toward the imam, hence the Sheikhi label of head-standers, bolasari, for the Usulis. Sheikhi adepts were often of village or small-town backgrounds and accustomed to the austere life of the countryside, which was at odds with the lifestyle of some of the established Mojtahids in Iran. The associated Sheikhi merchants and artisans, to the extent we know about them, shared with Rashti and his students the ideals of material detachment and ethical rectitude, characteristics they no longer identified with the ulama establishment. The Usuli denunciation of Ahsai and attempt to excommunicate Rashti outraged the Sheikhi and further sharpened their aspirations for a messianic breakthrough. Rashti, whose inner circle recognized him as the gate, Bab, to the imam of the age, even foresaw a messianic revolt in the face of his Usuli harassers. Surely the bloody Karbala rebellion against the Ottoman authorities hastened such expectations. In 1842, the new governor of Baghdad province, Muhammad Jajib Pasha, died 1851, harshly reacted to Shi'i defiance of the Ottoman authorities, which included establishing Sunni state courts in Shi'i cities. The gang leaders of the revolt in Karbala and the Usuli Mojtahids who blessed it heeded Rashti's attempt at mediation and resisted the Pasha's warnings. The result was the Ottoman massacre of close to 9,000 Shi'i civilians, nearly half the population of the city of Karbala. The Sheikhi leader's willingness to cooperate with the Ottomans saved some lives. Those who showed allegiance to Rashti were spared, and Rashti himself emerged as a voice of moderation, presumably favouring the Ottoman judicial and administrative reforms. The heavy-handed assault, endorsed by the Sublime Porte, nevertheless was in brazen contrast to what the Tanzimat era of reforms was supposed to usher in, greater latitude toward minorities. In reality, it reasserted Istanbul's full control in place of the pro-Shi'i Mamluk rulers of Iraq. To the Shi'i victims, the Turkish atrocity was another sign of Shi'i disempowerment in the face of Sunni oppressors. Only four decades earlier, in 1802, the Shi'is of Karbala and Najaf had witnessed a horrifying assault, that time by the marauding Wahhabi warriors of the Najd in the Arabian Peninsula, who considered it their religious duty to massacre nearly 5,000 Shi'i civilians and plunder and destroy Shi'i holy shrines. In both instances, the killing of innocents and the defiling of the shrine of Imam Hussein distressed the Iranian public, and both times the upheavals demonstrated the Qajar state's inability to defend the Shi'is of Iraq or alleviate their suffering. It was against this complex sectarian backdrop that the Babi movement found its first adherents. The Babi movement and doctrine of renewal. As a significant consequence of the Shaykhi teaching, the Babi movement echoed the ongoing crisis both in Shi'i Iraq and in Qajar Iran. In 1844, a young merchant from Shiraz, called Sayyid Ali Muhammad, 1819-1850, proclaimed to a small group of young Shaykhi mullahs who had come from Karbala to pay their allegiance to him, that he was the gate, Bab, to the truth. This was interpreted not only as a claim of Rashti's succession, but also a representation on behalf of the hidden Imam. The Bab, as he came to be known, called upon all believers to denounce the Mujtahid's authority in favour of his proclamation, for which he offered as proof verses composed in the style of the Quran. His messianic call for the imminent coming of the Mahdi attracted young converts across Iran and Shi'i Iraq, among mullahs, seminarians, merchants, and small-time bazaar retailers, artisans, urban and later village women, divan functionaries, small landowners, and soon villagers and landless labourers. The loose network of the early Babi converts conveyed the new message to an eager public and to Shi'i authorities, calling on them to recognise the advent, Zahur, of the Bab as the only sacred source of authority, or else await dire consequences at the Mahdi's impending advent. The spread of the new movement stirred some enthusiasm in Shiraz, but soon the Bab and his followers were denounced heretics and became targets of growing harassment. Even the Shaykhis, loyal to the old school, turned against them. At the instigation of the Mujtahids, who feared the movement's rapid growth, government authorities intervened, especially after the Bab claimed that he was the awaited Mahdi himself, and soon afterward when he further asserted that he was not only the Mahdi of Shi'i faith, but also the initiator of a new prophetic cycle. His new religion, he claimed, had brought an end to the Islamic prophetic cycle and had initiated a new order in which Islamic Sharia and its representatives were no longer legitimate. Predictably, any claim to the imminent advent of the Mahdi, who was safely relegated to theological limbo, was bound to be treated as blasphemous. In the coming years, Babi efforts to engage the ranking jurists in peaceful debate were dismissed offhandedly as ludicrous and heretical. Facing more persecution, the radicalized Babis called for more drastic action against their opponents, especially the ulama, whom they criticized for their illicit material gains, conservatism, and insolence toward the new prophet. Between 1848 and 1851, the Babis were forced to take up arms against the government. The move proved detrimental. By 1852, the movement had been suppressed and its leadership killed, exiled, or driven underground, only to re-emerge as a clandestine religion of protest in the following decade. Eventually, the prevailing faction within the movement, which denounced violence in favour of peaceful moral reconstruction, prophetic continuity, and interfaith tolerance, emerged as the Baha'i faith in the final decades of the 19th century. The young Bab, who was born to a family of petty merchants and clothiers with a clerical connection, had gained some business training in his family's outlet in Bushehr. When he first made his claims public, he was engaged in local trade in the south, importing tea and other items from India and exporting them along with dried fruits and other local products of the Fars province to the Iranian interior. The young Shaykhis, who had given their allegiance to him, were mostly from the villages and small towns of Khorasan and Azerbaijan. The Bab's proclamation in May 1844 marked a turning point in the evolution of the Shaykhi inner circle to an open movement with a public following. Shaykhi teachings, complemented with memories of sectarian tensions in Karbala, charged these eager followers. Their adherence to a young merchant from Shiraz, with a reputation for sanctity and devotion, but no clerical credentials, was highly unconventional. It no doubt denoted a search for a charismatic leader from outside the sphere of the madrasa. Thanks to the energetic Mullah Hussein Boshrui, the Bab's first convert and a key figure in shaping the movement, by 1848 there were Babi cells in most cities in Iran and in the Shi'i shrine cities of Iraq. Almost from his first public proclamation in his hometown of Shiraz, the Bab was labelled a heretic and soon after put under house arrest. Even though for a while he took refuge with Isfahan's governor, Manoucher Khan Mutamad al-Dowleh, who took a serious interest in him and his message, he was soon deprived of his protector. While still in hiding in Isfahan, sheltered by the governor, at his request the Bab wrote a treatise on the validity of Muhammad's prophetic mission, an indication no doubt of Manoucher's ambivalence about Islam as a divine religion. That the Bab penned the treatise to convince his patron also confirmed his belief in the cyclical recurrence of prophetic revelations, of which he considered himself the latest. However, upon the death of the Isfahan governor, perhaps foul play devised by Haji Mirza Agassi, the Bab lost a powerful protector, and with him any realistic chance to successfully expand his mission. In 1846, unable to meet with Muhammad Shah, who had initially invited him to the capital to hear his call, the Bab was rerouted halfway to Tehran by the order of the Premier, then sent off to the fortress of Maku in Azerbaijan, a safe Akhazi territory at the northwestern corner of the Russian and Ottoman borders. It was in the seclusion of the remote fortress that he articulated the Babi doctrine in his most systematic work, Bayan, literally explication, that is, of divine secrets. Composed in the style of the Quran, but with heavy esoteric undertones, the Bayan offered a mélange of occult Shi'i beliefs, elements of modern social ideas, and kernels of a cyclical view of history that consciously strived to break away from Islam. The Bab envisioned his mission as the most recent among prophetic cycles that were divinely inspired and progressively renewed toward the gradual perfection of humankind, what came to be known in Babi thought, and later for the Baha'is, as progression of the divine megacycle. Messianic Shi'ism, whether in its Ismaili era or during other trends in the Iranian world, long had adopted the idea of prophetic cycles, a notion shared with ancient Zoroastrian belief in renewal, farashkat, at the end of consecutive millennial cycles. The Quran also accepted the idea of a chain of divine revelations that went back to Abraham and through the biblical line to Adam, the first human and the first prophet. Such concepts of religious reification seem to have had their origins in the Manichaean religion of the 2nd century CE, which was widespread throughout the Iranian world. The Islamic orthodoxy considered Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, as the seal of the prophets, Khatam al-Nabiyin, and his religion as the most perfect and the final one until the end of time. The idea of perfection through time cycles, however, was never abandoned in heterodox circles or in the speculative mysticism of medieval Islam. Though the theory of cycles was often reconciled with the idea of Islam's perfection, the idea of the advent of the Mahdi at the end of time, especially in Shi'ism, remained the major conduit for survival of the idea of cyclical revelation. The Babi doctrine interpreted resurrection not as an apocalyptic destruction of the material world, but as the eclipse of one revelatory cycle and the dawn of the next. Relying on a long history of millennial speculations, the Bab utilized the familiar metaphor of seasonal changes to explain the nature of cyclical progression. The tree of prophethood, as he called it, blossoms in the spring, gains strength in the summer, bears fruit in the fall, and dies in winter, only to be reborn in the next seasonal cycle. It is the same tree, and yet it is different every year as it grows with time. The sense of historical relativism embedded in this notion of prophetic renewal acknowledged historical change. It allowed for the potential for human innovation and promoted a forward-looking perspective, concepts that defied the essentially regressive worldview of the Shi'i orthodoxy. The human potential for moral and intellectual growth through these cycles was immense, echoing the Neoplatonic thought widely appreciated in the Persian mystical milieu. Bayan implied that humankind not only can climb to a prophetic status, but in fact can surpass that status by mirroring the light of the divine sun in its entirety. The Babi intention was to make this reality explicit and final. The Babi endeavor, it can be argued, was striving to build in its own esoteric language an indigenous concept of modernity that relied on historical progression rather than the sanctity of the past. Likewise, it called implicitly for human agency rather than prophetic finality. In this light, the Babi message should be seen as the fulfillment of more than a millennium of Shi'i apocalyptic yearnings to break with Sharia, and more specifically, with the Sharia that had been set in place with the rise of the Safavid Empire. A messianic community in revolt. The making of the Babi community in a way resonated an important social momentum. As a grassroots movement, it brought together, perhaps for the first time, converts from all over Iran, from different occupations and social groups, to share a new objective based on their own individual convictions rather than their traditional loyalties, geographies, or ethnicities. A national community in the making, it was independent of both the state and the ulama establishment, and it eventually opposed both of them. It was a network patterned more on the needs of the bazaar than of the madrasa, and therefore was symptomatic of mercantile and artisan aspirations and deprivations, as well as those of other marginalized and underprivileged groups. Its inconsistencies aside, and there were many, and its destructive preoccupation with fulfilling Shi'i messianic prophecies, the nascent Babi faith carried with it the kernel of a new national identity. The Bab wrote some of his works, including the Bayan, in Persian, which he considered a sacred language, like Arabic. Babi theology was encoded with scores of familiar Persian theosophical and mystical terms and notions. He designated his birthplace, the ancient Fars province, as the sacred land of the Bayan, and the house in Shiraz, where he first declared his mission, the direction of the Babi's daily prayers. He adopted a novel, Badi, solar calendar, consisting of 19 months, with each month consisting of 19 days. The start of the year was the Persian Nowruz celebration at the vernal equinox. The new calendar, with its first year being the start of his mission in AH 1260, 1844 CE, was to replace the lunar Islamic Hijra calendar. A drastic change of calendar conveyed more than the sheer computation of time. It symbolically denoted the advent of a new era. While still a junior merchant in the Persian Gulf port of Bushehr, the Bab had witnessed some display of Europe's industrial power and naval force. His Letters of the Gospel, Harufe Enjil, as he often identified the Europeans, were threatening and yet appealing, both characteristics that anticipated the Iranian ambivalence, and more generally that of the non-Western world toward the West. In his writings, he applauded European manufacturing and allowed for trade with Europeans within certain limits. He prohibited their commercial penetration into the land of Bayan unless they could bring useful trade and occupations. He considered their gifts ritually pure and acceptable. He praised their material advances, their cleanliness, and their outward dignity. He was impressed by their legible handwriting, efficient postal communication, and press and publications. Despite these approbations, however, the Bab believed that as long as Europeans denied the veracity of the Prophet of Islam, they could not be saved on the Day of Judgment. He expressed hopes that in future they would welcome his true message and be included among the Letter of Light. Despite its novel potentials, the Bayani religion remained entrapped in the heterodox milieu in which it was rooted. The Bab viewed his own mission and those of his early followers as the fulfillment of the Shi'i Islamic prophecies. The Shi'i tragic narrative of martyrdom became even more tangible as he and his followers faced persecution and death. He saw his own mission not only as a Mahdi and a new prophet who brought a divine creed, but also as the return of Imam Hussein, the paradigm of Shi'i martyrdom, an image of himself that anticipated his tragic end. The Bab's growing following, with little direct supervision from their detained leader, continued in Khorasan, Mazandaran, and elsewhere. Concerned with the rapid growth of the new movement, the ulama persuaded the reluctant government of Haji Mirza Agassi to act. A tribunal was held in the presence of the young crown prince Nasser ad-Din Mirza, 1831-1896, in Tabriz in 1847, to examine the Bab's claims. There, the Bab unequivocally declared himself none other than the Mahdi whom the Shi'is had been expecting for a whole millennium. The Bab's audacious claim had a number of important implications. For the first time in recent Islamic history, at least since the 15th century Noqtavi movement, a conscious break from Islam came at a time when Iran was experiencing a period of socio-economic inertia and foreign intrusion. The Babi uprising that later began in 1848 was in some respects the fulfillment of the apocalyptic prophecies anticipated by the Bab and his early followers. While most mullahs among the Babis opted for a jihad scenario as perceived in the Shi'i literature, others began to articulate the meaning of the interregnum after the abrogation of Islamic Sharia and the coming of a new age. Perhaps the most pivotal figure among the Babi leadership, with no less influence in shaping the movement than the Bab himself, was a young woman, the poet, scholar, and revolutionary proto-feminist Fatemeh Zarin Taj Barakani, better known as Qarrat al-Ayn, the apple of the eye, and by her Babi title, Tahereh, the pure. A remarkable figure in modern Iranian history, Tahereh is unique not only because she stood in contrast to the persistent misogynistic norms and attitudes of a patriarchal society, but also because she represented a break from the prevailing Sharia limitations, which were palpable to women of her background. Born to an influential and affluent family of Usuli Mojtaheds in Qazvin, Tahereh shared with her mother, her aunt, and her sisters a rarely known example of women with literary and scholarly interests. Despite her family's predominantly anti-Sheikhi stance, her senior uncle denounced Ahsahi, she studied in Karbala under Rashti and acquired proficiency, a rare achievement for a woman of her time. She accepted the Bab's claim in absentia, and the Bab, in return, included her among his Letters of the Living, a radical break from the gender barriers of the time. The Bab also defended her against the criticism of conservative Babis who were shocked by the young women's uninhibited demeanour. An independent woman with a growing following, both female and male, Tahereh eloquently defended herself in Arabic before the Mufti of Baghdad while under house arrest by Ottoman authorities on a charge of inciting anti-Shi'i sentiments. Married and with four children, but estranged from her husband, who was her first cousin, she was forced by family pressure to return from Karbala to Qazvin. Soon after her arrival, however, in 1847 she escaped house arrest when her uncle and father-in-law, the prominent Imam Jomeh of Qazvin, was assassinated by radical Babis. The assassination was the first violent Babi reaction to the rising tide of persecution. Shortly after her flight, and while in hiding, Tahereh attended a crucial gathering of the Babis in the village of Badasht in northern Iran in June and July 1848. The meeting was convened to discuss the future of the movement and the fate of the Bab, who was incarcerated in another remote castle in Chehri in western Azerbaijan near the Ottoman border. In the course of deliberations, Tahereh emerged as the leader of the radical faction, which was seeking not only a break with Islam, but also open defiance of the Shi'i ulama. Tahereh's public appearance at the Badasht gathering without a facial veil, niqab, during her public speech from a pulpit, shocked her fellow Babis as a symbolic breach of one of the most sacred Islamic mores. This was probably the first instance in the history of Islamic Iran that an urban Muslim woman had intentionally removed her facial veil in public, an act that remained unrepeated for at least another half a century. Echoing the Bab, she argued that the Babi movement was an independent revelation that abrogated the Islamic cycle and that in the post-Sharia interregnum, religious obligations were no longer binding. In contrast, the charismatic leader of the opposing faction, The young Malama Hamad Ali Mazandarani, better known by his Babi name Qudus, rejected a complete break with the Islamic past and viewed the Bab's mission only as fulfillment of Shi'i prophecies. The Badasht debate brought to the surface a major dilemma. While Tahereh's position, that the Babi faith was independent of Islam, prevailed, the opposing camp succeeded in impressing on the gathering a need for a messianic jihad, a course of action fashioned by the Shi'i scenario of the advent of the Mahdi. Given the growing hostility the Babis were experiencing, mostly from the ulama's corner, and the bleak prospects of any sympathies, let alone protection, from the Qajar state, the Babis could hardly have opted for a more disastrous course. The fateful armed resistance in the fortress of Tabarsi in central Mozandaran during 1848 and 1849 embodied both of these tendencies. Emboldened by prospects of a millennial victory and encouraged by the political unrest after the death of Muhammad Shah, a band of Babis from Khorasan, headed by Bozhrui, marched toward Azerbaijan to liberate the Bab from captivity. The armed Babi contingent, no more than 200 in number, poorly equipped and poorly armed, faced harassment from the local government militia in the city of Barfarush, today's Babol, where they were temporarily stationed. Fearing for their lives, the Babi contingent moved out of town and eventually took temporary refuge inside a small structure over the shrine of Tabarsi in the thick of the forest, some 25 miles south of Barfarush. Fellow Babis, among them Qudus, were soon joined by other Babis from all over Iran, as well as new converts from among the smaller landowners and peasants in the vicinity. Loyal to their messianic vision, the besieged Babi party engaged the government forces for several months in bloody partisan warfare. Despite early successes, soon starvation, casualties, and low morale brought them to an ignominious surrender, which was followed by the execution of nearly all remaining fighters. As in many messianic movements of the same nature, the Tabarsi community, while still hopeful, lived an austere camp life with communistic ideals. Most significant, the leadership of the movement during the Tabarsi resistance evolved. Since the incarcerated Bab could not assume the movement's active leadership, both Bozhrui and Qudus were identified as risers, Ka'em, another name for the Mahdi that previously had been applied only to the Bab. The diffuse Babi leadership and democratization of the notion of the Mahdi were not entirely alien to the collective vision of its founder, as evident in the concept of the 18 Letters of the Living and the utopian community modelled on the unity of 19. Deeply preoccupied with numerology and numerical value inherent in letters of the alphabet, the Bab held the number 19 as the organizational cornerstone of his emerging community. Within this community, the role of the Mahdi could be shared among the Letters of Living, a feature symbolic of the egalitarian traits inherent in the movement. The failure of the Tabarsi community and the loss of more than 400 lives left a lasting mark on Babi morale. Other insurrections in Zanjan in northern Iran, in Nehriz in Fars province, and elsewhere lacked Tabarsi's revolutionary flair, even though they were as intense and as bloody as the Tabarsi affair. In Zanjan, where the Babis briefly controlled some quarters inside the walled city, there were more than 5,000 Babi casualties in the factional fighting and in clashes with government forces. The Nehriz uprising, in contrast, was fueled by the peasants' revolt against landowners and tax collectors. In all instances, the Babi message motivated dissent and gave the people a sense of agency and hope for their eventual triumph. The Qajar state, under the new premier, Mirza Taqi Khan Amir Kabir, had to invest a great deal of its military and financial resources to extinguish Babi insurrections. In 1850, when the Bab himself was brought to Tabriz to be executed by firing squad, he stood his ground to the end, despite great pressure to recant and gain his freedom. His public execution in the courtyard of a military barracks was the first in Iran to be conducted in the European military style. It was aimed not only at crushing the revolt and intimidating its sympathizers, but also at displaying the restored power of the Qajar government under the new chief minister. 2 years after the execution of the Bab, an unsuccessful assassination plot against the new ruler, Nasser ad-Din Shah, reigned 1848 to 1896, cost the lives of the movement's remaining prominent leaders. In a frenzy of torture and killing orchestrated by the government, Qajar princes, the clergy, merchants, and bureaucrats took part in a gruesome mass execution. A short while after, Tahereh, who had been held in detention by the governor of Tehran, was brought before two mujtahids, who, after long and inquisitive debate, issued a death sentence on charges of blasphemy. One late night, in secret, a drunkard ghulam, on the orders of the commander-in-chief of the army, killed Tahereh, suffocating her by stuffing a scarf in her throat. Her body was dumped in a shallow ditch at the edge of a garden outside the capital. At the time, she was 38. Tahereh's death signified the end of the first phase of the movement. 8 years into its inception, the Babi call had gained popularity despite widespread persecution of its followers. The movement's political defeat signified a chance to articulate a new, though sketchy, version of religious reform inspired by the inner dynamics of Shi'i Islam. This was at a critical juncture when Iranian society had become more conscious of its own national identity, more aware of external military and economic challenges, and more critical of the shortcomings of its own state and religious institutions. In this sense, the Babi movement was a messianic answer to the millennium-long unresolved question of temporal versus sacred authority. The concept of divine progression and renewed cycles, though not new in Iranian Shi'i thought, found a new resonance in Babi teaching. That the movement emerged just before Iran's full exposure to imported models of modernity in the second half of the 19th century adds to its significance. Despite its many shortcomings, the Babi movement anticipated the alliance of small-time merchants, artisans, low-ranking clergy, and other voiceless and marginalized groups a half a century later, during the Constitutional Revolution. The suppression of the Babi movement under Amir Kabir, a modernizer with Western notions of state-enforced reforms, in effect exemplified the clash between two visions of change. The state's actions did not eradicate the movement, but forced it underground and banished abroad any remnants of its leadership. That the Babi project could not succeed in its original phase was in part because of its inability to disengage from its Shi'i past. The Bab's language of prophecy and perception of change did carry the important kernel of renewal. However, it was often imbued with mystical and metaphorical language, unable to create a cohesive program of rational modernity. In later decades, the division of the majority Baha'is versus the minority Azalis would reflect more than a succession dispute. It highlighted competing visions. Whereas the Azalis remained mostly committed to political dissent, the Baha'is eventually aimed for a universalistic vision of moral renewal. During the leadership of Baha'u'llah, 1817 to 1892, the Babi movement, in a period of more than half a century between the upheavals of 1852 and the virtual end to Ottoman exile in Palestine in 1909, adopted an ecumenical message of universal reconciliation and socio-moral modernity. Most of the Babis of Iran, first simply known as People of Baha, paid their allogeneic to the new prophet. Born to a family of affluent landowning officials of the Qajar Divan, Mirza Hossein Ali Nuri, later known by his Babi title Baha, Radiant Glory, and afterward Baha'u'llah, throughout the period of his exile in Baghdad, 1853 to 1864, and later in the old Ottoman capital, Edirne, and eventually from 1869 to 1892 in the Ottoman penal colony of Akka in Palestine, rendered a novel mystico-moral message. This was mostly a non-Sharia rethinking of divine command, Amr, that, unlike nearly all Islamic modernist trends of the time, tried to fuse the perso-Islamic Sufi heritage of Iran, such as Sohrawardi's illumination philosophy, with European modern humanist and universalist endeavors. Moving beyond the then-prevalent paradigm of territorial nationalism, Baha'u'llah did not remain impartial to some ideals propagated by some leaders of the young Ottomans, his co-prisoners, and to the reforms of the Tanzimat era. His approach to such social notions as universal peace racial and gender equality, economic justice, and the rudiments of a democratic model, were groundbreaking, though mostly inspirational. As a step beyond Babi millennialism, the Baha'i message was fused with familiar Sufi imagery of the Sun of Truth, projecting on the mirror of the human heart. Maturation of human status, Magamme Ensan, Baha'u'llah argued, calls for human agency to define the world almost independent from the biblical and Quranic notions of divine intervention. The new rendering of the doctrine of the unity of being, Vahdat-e Wujud, appealed to the post-apocalyptic Babi community of Iran, which absorbed the evolutionary rather than the revolutionary message coming from Akka and proselytized it through the nascent Babi network in the Iranian and eventually non-Iranian environments.